Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, we're going to be talking to author Kim Stanley Robinson about life in a future submerged New York. But first, this week, the White House unveiled the president's proposed budget with a hefty boost to defense spending and cuts for science, like slashing the EPA by over 30%. Joining me now to talk about how science fared and other selected short subjects in science is Amy Nordrum, associate editor at the IEEE Spectrum back here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Amy.
Thanks, Ira.
Let's talk about what are some of the numbers we saw or should be watching from the proposed White House budget cuts.
Sure. So this is a $1.1 trillion spending plan for discretionary spending. It represents a cut of about 5.6% over the last fiscal year budget. And so in order to trim that, like you said, defense funding has increased. So the scientific agencies have certainly taken a hit. You mentioned the EPA, a reduction of 31%. The National Institutes of Health also suffered an 18% proposed reduction. This is a 15-year low for that agency, which has generally received pretty strong bipartisan support. You know, they're doing work on cancer research, looking into heart disease, epidemiology studies, things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. And now this is just the proposal. Things obviously can and usually do change once
Absolutely.
It goes through Congress, right?
Yeah, they're calling it a blueprint, and they're actually putting forward a more detailed proposal in about 2 months, so we should know more then. I mean, there were certain agencies that weren't even on this plan at all, like the National Science Foundation, and very little was said about the Food and Drug Administration. So we're still kind of waiting for details about what will happen or what's the plan in store for those agencies.
Does it look like an anti-science theme about the budget cuts?
You know, a lot of agencies across the board received at least some intense reductions. NASA's budget probably fared the best of any, yeah. And it was about 5% reduction. And also a kind of a change in mission there. I mean, they're telling NASA to maybe stop focusing so much on Earth and look more toward deep space science and other planetary exploration. So, there's some more subtle changes in there as well that we might see over the next 4 years.
On the other hand, they said they're going to cut out the Europa mission. Yeah, to go to sample something, you know, in Europa, which everybody was hoping for.
Yeah, there's a few specific programs that they've named that they will actually be cutting or hoping to cut. Another one was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's longtime Sea Grant program that helps support ocean and coastal research at a lot of universities across the country. There are a couple specific programs named, and then as far as the other budget cuts, we'll just have to kind of wait and see how those agencies handle them.
Well, let's move on to something different. This week, news about stem cell research in the eye. There's sort of good and bad news here.
Absolutely. You know, stem cells in the right hands seem to be a very promising potential treatment for a lot of different diseases. But there are also a lot of unregulated clinics that are doing treatments here in the United States that can sometimes take a negative turn. So there were two interesting reports published this week in the New England Journal of Medicine that kind of show both sides of that picture. One was from a Nobel Prize-winning team, a stem cell researcher in Japan, who did a very careful and meticulous job treating one eye of a single patient for macular degeneration. And they used cells of the retina that were derived from stem cells, injected them into the eye to form a sort of sheet behind the photoreceptors of the eye. And this treatment, 1 year after it was done, they believe has led to the stopping of the visual loss that you would typically see with macular degeneration. Mm-hmm. So this is considered a success and no adverse effects there. Now, the second report, unfortunately, talked about three patients who received treatment in Florida in which doctors performed liposuction, collected a slurry of cells, some of which were probably stem cells, but some of which could have not been, and injected those cells into both eyes of those three patients. And those three patients, one of them went completely blind, and then two others suffered substantial visual loss. So this is a kind of a story of, two contrasts here. I mean, we're talking about a very well-done scientific research trial in Japan, very carefully done and meticulous, and then, unfortunately, these unregulated stem cell clinics in the U.S. where you don't really know what you're getting all the time when you walk in.
Yeah, it's a cautionary tale about going too quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and not doing some peer-reviewed science. Well, you have a story about hacking a phone with sound waves.
This was a fun demonstration done by the University of Michigan. So in our smartphones and lots of other devices, we have accelerometers, and they can tell us, you know, which way is up and down, and they track the motion of users typically. A team at the University of Michigan has shown that they can fool these accelerometers into thinking that they're moving when they're really not using sound waves. So this was an interesting trick. They did it by using the resonant frequency of the accelerometers. So that's the frequency at which every sound wave and the vibrations within it, you know, reinforce the effect on the accelerometer of the previous sound wave. So you get a larger effect than you would have otherwise.
Wow. Wow.
They used this and they did a couple of neat demos. For example, one of them, they showed a Fitbit that was logging 2,100 steps in just 40 minutes, and that was because they were broadcasting sound at the right frequency toward the accelerometer.
Wow, good, great story. Finally, you have there's news about a fluorescent frog.
This is the world's first fluorescent frog, which is a bit of a tongue twister.
You did very well.
Thank you. It was found by some herpetologists at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. And it's called the South American polka dot tree frog. Not only does it fluoresce, but it also has red polka dots all over it. The researchers found that this frog, unlike any other amphibian that we know of, and many terrestrial animals can fluoresce. So that's different, of course, than bioluminescence, in which animals produce their own light, such as fireflies. Fluorescence is actually pretty rare in terrestrial animals. It's a lot more common in ocean creatures. So this was a neat discovery and a fun one for them to report.
It takes ultraviolet light, black light, for it to fluoresce.
Yes, in order for you to be able to see it. So now they're suggesting herpetologists like go around in the forest carrying UV lights so that they can shine them over the frogs and see if there's more species like this.
Yeah, well, does that mean a frog can see UV light if it fluoresces in it?
So that is one of the topics that they're hoping to follow up. Study, can the frog actually see its own fluorescence, or can the frog see the fluorescence of another frog of its species? And they don't know that yet, so they're going to be studying the photoreceptors to figure that out.
Imagine the wild bedroom photos, posters in the frog's bedroom. You'll be like,
it's a pretty neat trick.
I mean, it is a neat treat. Thank you very much, Amy. Amy Nordstrom, Associate Editor at the IEEE Spectrum. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Ira.
And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Now imagine you have an accident, you call 911, and an ambulance arrives. The EMTs load you in, and the ambulance drives off on its own. A robotic vehicle. A self-driving ambulance. Would you want that? Researchers with the Florida Institute of Technology and Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University looked at that question, and they found that's not everybody's cup of tea. Joining me now to talk about the good and the bad is Stephen Rice, Associate Professor of Human Factors at Embry-Riddle and one of the authors of that study. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
No, you're welcome. Let's talk about the good thing. What is the good thing about this? Why would we want an autonomous ambulance?
Well, so the good things are at least threefold. First, it's safer. We know that driverless vehicles rarely have accidents. They're caused by the automation. The accidents that have been reported are usually due to human error from other drivers. Second, it should be faster and smoother ride. The autopilot should be able to more efficiently perform its task and get to the hospital more quickly, which, as you know, in a traumatic situation is absolutely what we want to see. And then third, you get two paramedics in the back working on you instead of one. That's a big deal for you, particularly if you're in a critical situation and one of the paramedics may need to call a doctor for a prescription. The other one can still be working on you during that period.
And your study found that people aren't convinced this is a good thing.
No, they're not. Now, I've been doing a lot of research on autopilots and airplanes and cars for some time now, and then I met Joe Keebler, who is a medical human factors guy, and along with Scott Winter and Rian Mehta, we decided to take a look, you know, at the driver's ambulances, because that seems to be the logical future step in driverless cars. So we conducted three separate studies. We found that about over half of 1,000 U.S. adults were significantly less willing to ride in the driverless ambulance. Even when they would receive care from two paramedics instead of one, and quite a few of them were very negative about that and would absolutely refuse.
And so are they afraid that the ambulance is just too dangerous? They don't trust it?
Yes, in part, particularly with our male participants. The male participants showed quite a range of emotions from fear to happiness, which was odd. The ones who were willing to get in the ambulance were happy about it. The ones who were not willing to get in were afraid. On the other hand, female participants were even more negative about the driverless ambulances, but their emotional reaction tended to be anger rather than fear. or happiness. So you could argue, actually, that men were more emotional in their responses because they showed more emotions to justify their reasoning.
I'm tempted to say, why am I not surprised about this?
Your opinion is certainly not unusual. I mean, you know, we're finding that people tend to fear that which they do not know. And frankly, most folks don't know much about autopilots or driverless vehicles. I mean, we know they're out there, but really, does the common person know how it works? And when things are opaque and there's not a lot of information, then you tend to have situations where people don't want to play.
Yeah, but these are going to be, you know, the future, right? Uber is working on driverless cars in Pittsburgh. We have the driverless ambulances are going to happen, wouldn't you think?
Yes, I truly believe that, and I think that we're seeing the driverless cars have come a lot faster than we thought they would. And the next logical step is, you know, driverless ambulances, buses, and whatnot. There's also some bad points, you know, about this.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have people who are not willing to ride in ambulances and or would be afraid to get in them, then you're adding, you know, a great deal of stress to a patient who's already in a traumatic situation, and that's the last thing we want to do. And we've seen cases where human drivers are bullying autopiloted cars, you know, cutting them off knowing that they'll back off. And so we definitely want to, you know, take this a little more slowly, make sure that this is going to work out, and educate people to let them know, you know, how safe it is, and how they can benefit from it.
Well,
and perhaps even offer some free rides.
Yeah, you know, that's a new hashtag, autopilot bully. I haven't seen that one yet or heard about that one, but that is, I'm glad you brought that up, Stephen. It's actually
just happening because, you know, now we're getting more driverless cars and people are realizing, well, they'll back off if I just cut them off. And so that's what some people are tending to do.
All right, you heard it first here. Stephen Rice, Associate Professor of Human Factors at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. Great place to learn how to fly. Thanks, Stephen, for taking time to be with us today. We're going to come back. We're going to take a trip to a future flooded, submerged New York with Kim Stanley Robinson. It's his new book. He's going to share New York 2140 with us. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break.
On this week's On the Media, one former NPR editor's grievances are reverberating far beyond a Substack essay. He claims wokeness is ruining the place.
That marginalized people are storming the barricades and dictating that this story happens and this story gets killed and we're going to use this language and not use that language. That's not what I saw.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For decades, science fiction writers have tackled the theme of apocalyptic sea level rise, disastrous tides overtaking coastal cities, destroying homes and infrastructure, forcing residents to abandon once thriving metropolises with civilization barely hanging on. My next guest has explored the idea in his past books, like 2312 and the series Science in the Capital. And in his latest novel, Kim Stanley Robinson submerges New York City under 50 feet of rising sea level. But instead of a complete breakdown, he takes an optimistic view. The city and its residents have learned to adapt and actually thrive in the rising waters. He gives a glimpse of daily life. If you've ever spent a hot summer in the city, you can imagine the stench of 50 feet of standing water in the sun. And he also details what technological, economic, and social structures, business structures, we would need to survive sea level rise. Oh, yes, it is also a tale of mystery and intrigue. Kim Stanley Robinson's newest book is called New York 2140. He joins us today to talk about it. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. It's good to be back.
Good to have you back. Let me give out our number, 844-724-8255, if you'd like to talk about the book. 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us, and also you can listen online at sciencefriday.com. What made you decide to submerge New York under 50 feet of sea level rise here?
Well, I thought it'd be interesting, and we are going to have sea level rise, so it's not an unlikely scenario. And I wanted to write also about global finance and a kind of a revolution against global finance. And so setting it in New York with Wall Street underwater, it all kind of made sense.
Yeah, and then the last time we talked, if I remember correctly, was about your book Aurora. And you told me you were taking measurements around New York City, I guess, to figure out where the ocean would rise to?
That's right. There's a USGS topo map of Manhattan that includes all the streets, but also the contour intervals of what the elevations are. So I got one out and marked 50 feet, which was somewhat arbitrary, but what it did was it got downtown underwater all the time, and parts of Midtown are a tidal zone that's pretty broad, where at high tide it'd be underwater and at low tide it'd be exposed. So it was a fun project to walk the city and do that. And I want to add that, of course, floods of this level would be a monumental disaster and a bad thing. But what my book points out is that after that happens, and some version of that is going to happen, people will continue to cope. And New York is a place that people aren't going to abandon. So the coping is going to be interesting.
So it's sort of like it's been described as a super Venice in the book.
Yes, Venice was an important model for me. I've been to Venice four times through the years and been fascinated by it most of my life. And when you're there, you see that a city can function with canals instead of streets and without any cars. And in some ways, it's quite beautiful, like a work of art where you have to cooperate with a tidal zone. It's weird. There's no doubt about it, but interesting.
Did you? Are there any little little Easter eggs in the book, visual jokes in there that we might recognize for those of us who live in the city?
Well, I have all my characters living in the oldest MetLife Tower, which is down on Madison Square, built in 1890. And the reason I chose that building is that the architect of that building, Napoleon Lebrun, modeled it on the Campanile in San Marco Plaza in Venice. So essentially, we have a Venetian bell tower there in the middle of Manhattan, and it seemed like the right place to put my people.
It does look just like it.
It's modeled on it, yeah.
Yeah. In the book, people are living in these self-sustaining communal skyscrapers, as you say, that are being battered by water. What are some of the techniques that you had to install in these buildings to make them still survive as buildings, to make them work?
Well, it's taken out of ordinary skyscraper construction and also Venice itself. You would need to give up on the floors that are in the tidal zone, and they become a kind of a combination of wet storage and a boathouse, really. And then above that, you have to have your power, and photovoltaic power, skyscraper farms, water tanks, as in New York already. Everything would have to be shifted and used in ways that would be adapted to a kind of a Venetian context. And New York is an estuary, and there's already a lot of New York infrastructure that has to deal with being underwater. So it would be an extension of what we already do.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Let's go to Omaha. Braden, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I was wondering if the sea level rise high enough and how long would it be for it to get back down?
How long?
Yeah. Oh, that's a great question. Sea level rise, we don't know how fast it can go because it depends on ice sliding off of Greenland and Antarctica. That's how it would happen. If all the ice on this planet were to melt, sea level would rise by about 220 to 270 feet. So that's considerable, and in my book I only portray 50 feet, which would take a few hundred years. Now, you ask how long would it take to shrink that back down. There's actually an institute in Germany that has investigated pumping water back onto the top of Antarctica, letting it freeze there. You would have to take about 20% of all the electricity that humanity generates right now, and you would have to have about 60 essentially oil rigs, pipelines, scattered around Antarctica, working in the summertime only, using solar power so you don't burn more carbon doing this. And then it would take you about, if you started right at the beginning, you could hold it off forever. But if you were recovering the situation, it would take about as long as it took to flood. In other words, maybe about 100 years.
In fact, in your book, you described that the flooding didn't happen all at once, that there were three different pulses or floods that happened. Did you calculate how these would happen on real environmental events that are going on? Or how did you decide that's the way it would happen?
It's an extrapolation of how glaciers move. Usually they're frozen to the rock under them, but if they get onto a layer of water, then they're like on skimboards and they slide quickly. So there's a slide and stop movement to ordinary glaciers. Last year, James Hansen and 18 co-authors published a paper where they calculated what sea level had done 120,000 years ago, which is like with a one temperature rise of average global temperature, which we've already done. There was about a 10-meter sea level rise in a single century, and it was mysterious. And what Hansen and his people postulate is that warmer oceans circulating around Antarctica release glaciers that are perched over the water and only held in place by dams that are made of ice itself. So as soon as warm water gets underneath those dams, and in one phrase that I love, they call it the buttress of the buttress, then you get a sudden slide. So what I was postulating, and really this is very science fictional, I'm just guessing, is that things would go fast for a while and then stabilize for a while and then maybe go fast again.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Georgia, to Wayne in Georgia. Hi, Wayne. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello.
Hey there.
Happy to be able to say anything. I was just wondering about what would happen with the transit system, you know, as you said, Venetian and whatever. Avenues to be able to get around with the Big Apple, being so dependent upon the transit system and everything. What would happen to that? Would it be submergible, or what would happen to all the transit system that gets people around in this very populated metropolis?
Yeah, good question. What happens to the subways?
Okay. Well, the subways drown when they're underwater, and about 60% of New York subways are underground and would be drowned and would be used, I suppose, as utilidors with essentially automated submarines, like these automatic cars that you were talking about in the last segment, moving stuff around, but not people. Then you'd get around on the surface like they do in Venice in boats. The buses are vaporettos. And I suppose in New York you could set skylines like the High Line over in Manhattan's West Side, where you could walk above the water level and new kind of balconies or corridors. It would be hard. It would slow things down. It would be an impaction. And also you have to remember that global trade depends crucially on container ships. The entire global economy depends on ports. And when they're drowned, you would have a massive disruption of global trade and, in essence, a worldwide depression in economic terms, extraordinarily disruptive. So I don't want to misrepresent the situation. Sea level rise would be a stupendous disaster that some people calculate would cost like $1.5 quadrillion. That would be $1,500 trillion. Hmm. And I think that's actually too low, because world trade is what we now rely on for food and all of our goods. It would be extraordinarily disruptive, the transport problem. And also, if you don't want to burn carbon, I think you go back to sailing ships and dirigibles, and so everything slows down and becomes more labor intensive. But people need jobs, and once you have slowed down, you might find that you enjoy life more and you have more like meaningful full employment. So there are compensations.
In deciding the fate of New York, people always talk about, let's bring over the Dutch who have built floodgates, you know, things like that. But you chose to portray the city as flooded, not being able to keep out the waters. Why did you go in that direction and not into trying to build dikes or dams or things or floodgates?
Well,
do you
New
think
York
it's not a viable option?
I don't think it's a viable option. New York is a gigantic estuary, and when you think about the water that's pouring down the Hudson, which is absolutely a big watershed, you have both the Verrazano Narrows and then you have Long Island Sound through Hellgate. Where would you put these dams or barriers, and what would you try to stop, and what if it failed? So right now, the current plan, and it's quite an interesting one, is to build a barrier all the way around the south end of Manhattan, about 12 miles long, that would protect Manhattan from the kind of surges that we're going to be seeing really soon. Studies are being done, and they want to do this without disrupting the ordinary flow of Manhattan traffic and people. And it looks like it might be doable. But what my book portrays is the moment when sea level gets too high, when a barrier is overwhelmed, then you get a disaster. So it may be better just to let the estuary flood to its normal levels, whatever they may be, and then cope with it from there on.
And, you know, doing all of this costs and moving the population and building, you talk about it being flooded basically from 42nd Street down to the Battery, and sort of the Bronx is the new area where people are discovering or have rediscovered. And the financing for this, have you thought about what it takes to finance this tremendous change in the economy?
Well, yes, essentially the economy as such would become about adapting to the new circumstances. So in other words, the work of civilization, we would have to find ways to pay ourselves to do the necessary work of adapting to a different sea level, but also a different climate. This is already going to be happening to us. So what becomes interesting is calculating a new way of assigning value to our activities. In other words, paying ourselves to do the stuff that we have to do to survive. That isn't how the economic system works now, and so we always count these things as losses, but if it actually employs people and you end up doing new construction, it's a kind of an infrastructure project is what it comes down to, but designed to adapt to new conditions. One thing that bothers me as a kid from Southern California is all the beaches in the world are doomed. And that's true, not just a science fiction story. A sea level rise of a trivial amount, like 5 feet, will destroy all the beaches in the world. And that's sad, as well as bad. And what I'm thinking is that we may begin to try to become beach builders. And at the higher sea levels that we will have created, we may try to shift sand up and see if we're good at doing ecology of the coastal regions. About 10 to 20% of the world's populations live on the coasts. A lot of agriculture is on the coast. And, of course, aquaculture is based off of the coasts. All of these things are going to have to be dealt with in the real world. So my story focuses on Manhattan because that's an interesting and beautiful place and important. But it's not the only place that matters. It's just a sample of what's going to have to happen.
Talking with Kim Stanley Robinson, author of the new book, New York 2140, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Really interesting book, and you've woven lots of different stories and ideas in there, and you've taken on a lot of different issues, including sort of attacking the business community, saying that we really need a whole new way of doing business. And not to give away any spoilers, but it's about sort of bringing down the whole business system.
Well, let's talk about global finance as being a kind of a parasite on what some people call the real economy. So the financialization of our lives, where money is made out of the manipulation of money, we saw how that can impact the real economy in 2008. So a lot of my book's financial plot comes out of an alternative response to what happened in 2008. We nationalized GM at that point, got it back on its feet, but we actually just gave money to the banks and investment firms that had crashed the economy, and we gave them 100 cents on the dollar and told them not to do it again, and they proceeded to go back and do their best to do it again. There will be more bubbles. There will be more bubbles bursting. So at that point, I think we need a plan like the nationalization of General Motors, but that we nationalize the banks and that finance itself becomes a public utility, perhaps privately run, but publicly owned, a public utility district, finance itself. Well, this is, you know, shocking and revolutionary, et cetera, but it's also not that different from the way things have worked at various moments in history where the Keynesian balance between government and business sort of favored government. So it's a story to tell, and it's a way of responding, I think, to the crisis of the 2008-2009 crash. We need to do better next time. Mm-hmm. So I tried to tell that story, too, as a kind of utopian comedy. A comedy of the commons, a comedy of climate change, and a comedy of disaster. It doesn't immediately suggest itself, but it's a new story to tell.
We're going to take a break and come back and talk lots more with Kim Stanley Robinson about New York 2140. I want to do a couple of shout-outs. I want to tell you that he'll be joining us for his to talk about his newest book next week, Monday, March 20th, at Housing Works Bookstore. If you're in New York, if you're in the New York area or in New York City, you want to hear more, you want to meet Stan in person, ask him a question. Get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. As I say, that's going to be March 20th, next Monday at Housing Works Bookstore. You can go to our website at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. We'll be back, talk lots more with Kim Stanley Robinson about 2140. Take your questions. Our number, if you'd like to chime in, is 844-724-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're talking to author Kim Stanley Robinson about his latest novel about rising sea levels called New York 2140. Before the break, I talked about Stan being at our book club next weekend. It is March 20th, but it's at the Strand Bookstore, here in New York City next Monday. Tickets at sciencefriday.com/book club. So many people want to talk to you. Let me go to the phones. You mentioned New York City and you mentioned the beaches are from California. Somebody said, a tweet from Bianca who said, would San Francisco be part of this kind of sea level rise? And I guess, as you say, you just chose New York as an example, but it would be occurring all over the world.
Yes, it would. And you can look at your nearest coastal city and kind of estimate just by thinking about a certain sea level rise, say 50 feet. San Francisco is a hilly, and a lot of it would not be affected. But of course, down near the water, it would. Miami would be, not just Miami, but much of Florida would be underwater. And every coastal city has a different relationship to the ocean. There are cities that have a waterfront, like Chicago, that wouldn't be affected at all. So it's an odd scenario to explore the nooks and crannies of, mm-hmm. and interesting. But what I guess I want to say is that sea level is going to happen. So it isn't just a game that you play. It's a kind of a scenario of possible futures so that you can begin to prepare your thinking.
So you wouldn't agree with the president's budget director, Mike Mulvaney, who said yesterday that climate change research funding, it would be a waste of money.
No, I wouldn't agree. I'd say that's very heavily discounting the future generations, basically a Ponzi scheme that cheats the future generations who will be left holding the bag if we wreck things. It's the best investment we can make to actually prepare for a climate change future, because that's what we're actually heading into.
As they used to say in the 60s, we're borrowing our grandchildren's future today.
Yes, and you don't want to trash it. You want to add value.
Now, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Washington, D.C. Hi, Jim. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. Yeah, my question is, what factors did you research that would incentivize a city like New York and the people there to build on top of the water or adapt versus just moving inland or moving uphill? And how might that be different in other locales across the country? And how might that inform us going into the real world, a real future here?
Yeah. Good question.
That is a good question, because everybody'd make their own decisions. And refugee populations, if you're talking about the 1/10 of the world's population that is forced to make a change, a lot of them will move inland. There's no doubt about it. It'll be easier and more survivable, more food, more housing. Right at the coastline itself, it's going to be trashed for a generation or two. And some coastal areas, I imagine, will be abandoned, and there will just be a new coastal area that is miles inland. But New York is different. It's got a really intense infrastructure already there, with skyscrapers that are have steel supports right down into the bedrock. They're not going to fall over as sea level rises. They're going to be sticking out of the ocean or out of the tidal zone. And then after squatters, there will be new arrangements. It's legally ambiguous. Land that's underwater doesn't have the same legal status as it might not be property. And yet the buildings will be there. So it gets very curious. But I think of New York as so charismatic that a certain number of people will stick around or come back. Hmm. And it's a joke in the book, but a lot of people get by in New York by living in such terrible places already that you drown the place. And for some people, it won't make any difference. Or for some people, it'll be an upgrade.
Yeah, some people living on the roof. That's how it starts out, with two guys on the roof. What about the new idea that you float in your book, I guess, is creating floating islands, that new real estate on floating little islands hooked together, wired up?
I think that will happen in the coastal zones, and I think Holland is, of course, the Netherlands. They'll be in terrible trouble, and they already have had dikes protecting their country for centuries. They have to think new, and they are. And they've had these suggested kind of essentially island cities that are floating around in the ocean. If you were to anchor them to certain blocks in New York, there's a huge distinction in Manhattan that you can see with the naked eye from Hoboken, where you can put a building into bedrock, you've got skyscrapers. Where you've got landfill, you can't build skyscrapers, and that's where you got the low zones of Midtown that are only 3, 4, 5 stories tall. That's not an accident. They'd build a skyscraper there if they could, but they can't. If that area was flooded, those buildings would tend to melt into the drink, as my characters say. Now, at that point, if you could anchor a raft that is the size of a Manhattan block that was stuck in place and on stretchy cords so that it could rise and fall with the tides, you might be able to build a 3 or 4 story houseboat mm-hmm. that would fill a block and so adapt. And so this is kind of the game of science fiction, but humans do this too. How do you do it? Adapt to a situation where things have changed? What kind of ingenious workarounds will you come up with? And so, you know, that's one of the things that I wanted to do in this novel is have some fun with the idea, as perverse as that may sound.
You also have a woman who flies around in a dirigible, moving animals from one place to another. They've been flooded out or it's too warm for them, and especially the polar bears. And you have an experiment with trying to move polar bears to Antarctica because there's no place for them. There's no ice in the north anymore. It doesn't go so well.
No, this is a kind of shocking notion. There is in the biology community a thing called assisted migration, which they feel is probably better called managed relocation, where when climate change changes the ecological conditions such that species are going extinct where they are, you could perhaps move them some mostly latitude lines, north or south, to get them back to a zone where they could survive. And what this is trying to do is dodge extinctions. Well, the polar bears are in big trouble. The Arctic Sea is getting warmer. The sea ice goes away. Polar bears depend on it. Antarctica is completely different because it has a stack of ice that's 2 miles thick, and the ice will last there much longer. However, polar bears don't exist down there. So it would be the introducing of a top predator to an area that isn't used to it, and there would be a lot of environmentalists, or you might say wildlife purists, who would probably object to it. But if it's a case of survival, of avoiding extinction, people might do it.
I was surprised to see that none of your characters are scientists in this novel. You've talked all about climate change and the changes, but there are no climate scientists in this book. There are in your other books. Why not in this book?
Well, I've done that before in my Science in the Capital, and I guess this is a change of emphasis for me. The scientific community is doing their best to alert us to the problem and to suggest solutions. The rest of us are a little bit behind that curve, and it's a time for a new story to be told. How are we going to pay for it, this necessary work? So you get to finance. And then also what I'm enjoying is the idea that in my New York novel, it's actually just an ordinary New Yorker, sounds like a guy to me, a sports fan, fairly cynical, profane, somebody ranting, who knows enough to tell you the backstory, the scientific angles even, the history of what happened to New York. So in the place where I usually have scientist characters explaining things, I have a crazy New Yorker grabbing you like the Ancient Mariner and ranting about what happened, and it's just funnier.
Yeah, it's a great book, Stan. It's a great book. If you want to,
thank you.
See and talk to Kim Stanley Robinson, who's joining us about his book New York 2140. We are hosting a live talk with Stan this coming Monday, March 20th at the Strand, the very famous Strand. So if you're in New York and you want to hear more, or if you want to ask Stan a question in person, get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. That is next Monday, right after this weekend, next Monday, March 20th at the Strand at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. We'll see you on Monday. Stan, take it easy. Thanks for joining
us. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks, Ira.
It'll be great. Turning the page, the warm weather this winter means an early start for the maple syrup season. Producers started tapping trees as early as January this year, because that's got that warm this year. And now an early season, it is, you know, it's not always good news. The sap only runs for about 6 weeks, and if the temperatures aren't just right, it can end early or it could just stop flowing. And some producers are also seeing less of the highly valued fancy syrup, you know, that lightest colored variety that you pay for higher prices in the store. So what links can we draw between climate change and the future of our pancake toppings? Our next guests are working this stuff out. Selena Ahmed is an assistant professor of sustainable food and bioengineer systems at Montana State University in Bozeman. She's been researching what we can predict for the availability and quality of foods like maple syrup, even tea, spinach, others in a warming world. Dr. Ahmed, welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me on, Ira.
So what is wrong with having early spring where the maple syrup is concerned?
Well, there are several things, and one is just the increased uncertainty. Producers, you know, have particular labor schedules, and especially large producers that have a lot of trees to tap, there's a lot more uncertainty with what's happening with climate variability, and having earlier flows sort of makes things more unpredictable. Another thing is, as you know, maple sap and syrup needs very specific freeze-thaw cycles. And so it needs these above freezing temperatures in the daytime and below freezing temperatures at the nighttime. And so having sap come early and having maple syrup come early is wonderful. But then when we actually start getting another freeze cycle where we're not actually seeing those warming days, the sap actually stops flowing. And so that causes a lot of uncertainty for producers.
Are the trees actually stressed out by all this change?
Yes, the trees are also stressed out by the change. There is maple trees need specific freeze-thaw cycles, but they also like a lot of snowpack. And the changes in the snowpack, the warming, is actually causing a little bit of root dieback for the trees, and that's decreasing the health of the trees. And so sap essentially is water that's coming up through the roots, and by having unhealthier roots, that's really impacting the sap we're getting.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So what effect is that happening on the kind of maple syrup, the kind of sap, I guess, that you would be using to make the kind of maple syrup that we use?
Sure. So as you mentioned earlier, Ira, a lot of times couple of decades ago, producers would see a lot more of that high quality, light, fancy grade sap that you were talking about, or syrup, and that really had perhaps less phytochemicals or secondary metabolites. And so secondary metabolites are those compounds that plants produce when they're stressed, but we as humans a lot of times benefit from those compounds in terms of their flavor compounds as well as the health benefits. And so when plants are stressed, they're producing a little bit more of these compounds. And what we're seeing in our different sites where we're collecting maple sap and maple syrup is that in the areas that are warmer, in the southern range, we're actually seeing more of these, more sap with these secondary metabolites. And so indicating that the plants are a little bit more stressed in the southern range. And the flavor of maple syrup is very subjective. And so we've been doing some consumer research, and a lot of people prefer some of the darker syrups, and some people prefer some of the lighter syrups. But in terms of the health aspects, we know that the secondary metabolites are actually beneficial for health. Mm. However, too much of those compounds can actually produce an off flavor where consumers no longer have a preference for that type of syrup. And so we're seeing a lot of variability in terms of what's happening, and it's just becoming a lot more uncertain.
I know that you also spend a lot of time studying tea and climate change. How is tea like maple syrup?
Sure. So tea is also similar to maple syrup in that it needs specific environmental conditions for an ideal harvest. And so in most places where tea grows, it grows in three different seasons. And it has, very similar to maple, a winter dormancy. And the new buds come in the early spring season. And that also, like maple, is getting earlier every single year. And so producers actually are not excited about the early spring bud burst because they think that the trees need a winter dormancy to actually produce a healthy flush. And also in some places where it gets warm and then it gets cold, it actually, the frost causes leaf damage, and then producers actually lose their very healthy spring harvest. Hmm.
So I guess if you want to adjust to the climate change, if you're a farmer, you should then not plant a monoculture, but a variety of things, because it's unpredictable now what's going to happen.
Absolutely, yeah. And we're seeing that both in the maple syrup system as well as in the tea system. And so we're actually seeing producers of maple syrup who have historically mostly commercialized sugar maple. They're also starting to tap other trees such as red maple and birch. Very similarly in tea systems, I've been doing research looking at monoculture tea plantations in China and then comparing that to the quality of these indigenous agroforests, where farmers are not only growing tea of one variety, but they may grow up to 15 different farmer land races within the same tea system. And then the system is further diversified in terms of its structure, very much looking like a forest environment. So when I actually go into these tea gardens, it feels like it's a diversified forest. Wow. And farmers are actually relying on this diversified structure for ecosystem services, including managing for pests and disease and fertilizers. And so these are organic systems, diversified organic systems. And we're seeing that these systems are actually more resilient to climate variability, you know, kind of going through with the old age-old saying not to put all your eggs in one basket.
Right. Dr. Ahmed, could you come back and talk more about, you know, growing food and changing climate for us, sustainable farming?
Absolutely.
We've run out of time.
Okay, sure. So I think it's very important for consumers to have the take-home message to know that there is a lot of variability in terms of where our food is coming from and the environmental conditions. Some environmental variability is great for the flavor and health benefits of
All right.
Our
we'll have you back, Dr. Ahmed, to talk about it. Celine Ahmed is assistant professor. We've just pushed her up and up. Sustainable food and bioenergy systems at Montana State University in Bozeman. Just another reminder, Kim Stanley Robinson will be talking with us coming March, this Monday, March 20th at the Strand. Get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/bookclub. We'll see you on Monday in New York if you can make it. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Intagliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Christy Taylor, Katie Heiler, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, Jack Horowitz, our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. Speaking of which, I'm Ira Flatow in New York.